the Queen demanded, and the wretched Wat named Sir Talad the Tall, Lambert Turnberry, Jalabar Joe, the Red Wine Twins, Osney Kettleblack, Hugh Clifton, and the Knight of Flowers. That displeased her. She dare not besmirch the name of the hero of Dragonstone. Besides, no one who knew Sir Loris would ever believe it. The Red Wines could not be a part of it either. Without the Arbor and its fleet, the realm could never hope to rid itself of this Euron Crow's Eye and his accursed Iron Men. All you are doing is spitting up the names of men you saw about her chambers. We want the truth. The truth. Wat looked at her with the one blue eye that Qyburn had left him. Blood bubbled through the holes where his front teeth had been.
I might have misremembered.
Horace and Hubber had no part of this, did they?
No, he admitted, not them.
As for Sir Loris, I am certain Margaery took pains to hide what she was doing from her brother.
She did. I remember now. Once I had to hide under the bed when Sir Loris came to see her. He must never know, she said.
I prefer this song to the other. Leave the great lords out of it. That was for the best. The others, though, Sir Talad had been a hedge knight. Jalabar Joe was an exile and a beggar. Clifton, only one of the little queen's guardsmen. And Osney is the plum that makes the pudding. I know you feel better for having told the truth. You will want to remember that when Margaery comes to trial, if you were to start lying again.
I won't. I'll tell it through. And after.
You will be allowed to take the black. You have my word on that. Circe turned to Qyburn. See that his wounds are cleaned and dressed, and give him milk of the poppy for the pain. Your grace is good. Qyburn dropped the bloody razor into a pail of vinegar. Margaery may wonder where her bard has gone. Singers come and go. They are infamous for it. The climb up the dark stone steps from the black cells left Circe feeling breathless. I must rest. Getting to the truth was wearisome work, and she dreaded what must follow. I must be strong. What I must do, I do for Tommen and the realm. It was a pity that Maggie the Frog was dead. Piss on your prophecy, old woman. The little queen may be younger than I, but she has never been more beautiful. And soon she will be dead. Lady Merryweather was waiting in her bedchamber. It was the black of night, closer to dawn than dusk. Jocelyn and Dorcas were both asleep, but not Dana. Was it terrible? She asked. You cannot know. I need to sleep, but fear to dream. Dana stroked her hair. It was all for Tommen. It was. I know it was. Circe shuddered. My throat is raw. Be a sweet and pour me some wine. If it please you, that is all that I desire. Liar. She knew what Dana desired. So be it. If the woman was besotted with her, that would help ensure that she and her husband remained loyal. In a world so full of treachery, that was worth a few kisses. She is no worse than most men. At least there is no danger of her ever getting me with child. The wine helped, but not enough. I feel soiled, the queen complained as she stood beside her window, cup in hand. A bath will set you right, my sweet. Lady Merryweather woke Dorcas and Jocelyn and sent them for hot water. As the tub was filled, she helped the queen disrobe, undoing her laces with deft fingers and easing the gown off her shoulders. Then she slipped out of her own dress and let it puddle on the floor. The two of them shared the bath together, with Circe lying back in Tana's arms. Tommen must be spared the worst of this, she told the Mearish woman. Margaery still takes him to the Sept every day, so they can ask the gods to heal her brother. Sir Loris still clung to life, annoyingly. He is fond of her cousins as well. It will go hard on him to lose them all. All three may not be guilty, suggested Lady Merryweather. Why, it might well be that one of them took no part. If she was shamed and sickened by the things she saw, she might be persuaded to bear witness against the others. Yes, very good. But which one is the innocent? Allah, the shy one. So she seems, but there is more of sly than shy in her. Leave her to me, my sweet. Gladly. Alone, the Blue Bard's confession would never suffice. Singers lied for their living, after all. Alla Tyrell would be of great help if Tena could deliver her. Sir Osney shall confess as well. The others must be made to understand that only through confession can they earn the king's forgiveness and the wall. Jalabar Jo would find the truth attractive. About the rest, she was less certain, but Qyburn was persuasive. Dawn was breaking over King's Landing when they climbed from the tub. The queen's skin was white and wrinkled from her long immersion.
"Stay with me," she told Tena. "I do not want to sleep alone."
She even said a prayer before she crawled beneath her coverlet, beseeching the mother for sweet dreams. It proved a waste of breath. As ever, the gods were deaf. Circe dreamt that she was down in the black cells once again, only this time it was her chained to the wall in place of the singer. She was naked, and blood dripped from the tips of her breasts where the imp had torn off her nipples with his teeth.
"Please," she begged, "please, not my children. Do not harm my children."
Tyrion only leered at her. He was naked, too, covered with coarse hair that made him look more like a monkey than a man. "You shall see them crowned," he said, "and you shall see them die." Then he took her bleeding breast into his mouth and began to suck, and pain soared through her like a hot knife. She woke shuddering in Tana's arms.
"A bad dream," she said weakly. "Did I scream? I'm sorry."
Dreams turned to dust in light of day. Was it the dwarf again? "Why does he frighten you so, this silly little man?"
"He is going to kill me. It was foreseen when I was 10. I wanted to know who I would marry, but she said..."
"She? The Magi?" The words came tumbling out of her. She could still hear Malara Heatherspoon insisting that if they never spoke about the prophecies, they would not come true. She was not so silent in the well, though. She screamed and shouted.
"Tyrion is the Valonqar," she said. "Do you use that word in Myr? It's High Valyrian. It means little brother."
She had asked Septa Saranella about the word after Malara drowned. Tena took her hand and stroked it. This was a hateful woman, old and sick and ugly.
"You were young and beautiful, full of life and pride."
"She lived in Lannisport," you said. "So she would have known of the dwarf and how he killed your lady mother. This creature dared not strike you because of who you were. So she sought to wound you with her viper's tongue." Could it be? Circe wanted to believe it. "Malara died, though, just as she foretold. I never wed Prince Rhaegar, and Joffrey, the dwarf, killed my son before my eyes."
"One son," said Lady Merryweather, "but you have another, sweet and strong, and no harm will ever come to him.
Never whilst I live." Saying it helped her believe that it was so. Dreams turned to dust in light of day.
Yes.
Outside, the morning sun was shining through a haze of cloud. Circe slipped out from under the blankets. "I will break my fast with the king this morning. I want to see my son. All I do for him." Tommen helped restore her to herself. He had never been more precious to her than he was that morning, chattering about his kittens as he dribbled honey onto a chunk of hot black bread fresh from the ovens.
"Sir Pounce caught a mouse," he told her, "but Lady Whiskers stole it from him."
"I was never so sweet and innocent," Circe thought. "How can he ever hope to rule in this cruel realm?" The mother in her wanted only to protect him. The queen in her knew he must grow harder, or the Iron Throne was certain to devour him.
"Sir Pounce must learn to defend his rights," she told him. "In this world, the weak are always the victims of the strong."
The king considered that, licking honey off his fingers.
"When Sir Loras comes back, I'm going to learn to fight with lance and sword and Morningstar the same way he does."
"You will learn to fight," the queen promised, "but not from Sir Loras. He will not be coming back, Tommen."
"Margaery says he will. We pray for him. We ask for the mother's mercy and for the warrior to give him strength.
Eleanor says that this is Sir Loras's hardest battle." She smoothed his hair back, the soft golden curls that reminded her so much of Joff. "Will you be spending this afternoon with your wife and her cousins?"
"Not today. She has to fast and purify herself," she said.
"Fast and purify? Oh, for Maiden's Day. It had been years since Circe had been required to observe that particular holy day. Thrice wed, yet she still would have us believe she is a maid. Demure in white, the little queen would lead her hens to Bela's sept to light tall white candles at the maiden's feet and hang parchment garlands about her holy neck. A few of her hens, at least. On Maiden's Day, widows, mothers, and whores alike were barred from the septs, along with men, lest they profane the sacred songs of innocence. Only virgin maids could...
Mother, did I say something wrong?
Circe kissed her son's brow. You said something very wise, sweetling. Now run along and play with your kittens. Afterward, she summoned Sir Osney Kettleblack to her solar. He came in sweaty from the yard and swaggering, and as he took a knee, he undressed her with his eyes, the way he always did. Rise, sir, and sit here next to me. You did me a valiant service once, but now I have a harder task for you.
Aye, and I have something hard for you.
That must wait. She traced his scars lightly with the tips of her fingers. Do you recall the whore who gave these to you? I'll give her to you when you come back from the wall. Would you like that?
It's you I want.
That was the right answer. First you must confess your treason. A man's sins can poison his soul if left to fester. I know it must be hard for you to live with what you've done. It is past time that you rid yourself of your shame.
Shame? Osney sounded baffled. I told Osmond, Marjorie just teases. She never lets me do any more than...
It is chivalrous of you to protect her. Circe broke in. But you are too good a knight to go on living with your crime. No, you must take yourself to the great sept of Baelor this very night and speak with the High Septon. When a man's sins are so black, only his High Holiness himself can save him from hell's torments. Tell him how you bedded Marjorie and her cousins.
Osney blinked.
What? The cousins too?
Mega and Eleanor, she decided. Never Allah. That little detail would make the whole story more plausible. Allah would sit weeping and plead with the others to stop their sinning.
Just Mega and Eleanor? Or Marjorie too?
Marjorie, most certainly. She was the one behind it all. She told him all she had in mind. As Osney listened, apprehension slowly spread across his face. When she finished, he said,
After you cut her head off, I want to take that kiss she never gave me.
You may take all the kisses you like. And then the wall. For just a little while. Tommen is a forgiving king.
Osney scratched at his scarred cheek. Usually if I lie about some woman, it's me saying how I never fucked them and them saying how I did. This... I never lied to no High Septon before. I think you go to some hell for that, one of the bad ones.
The queen was taken aback. The last thing she expected was piety from a Kettleblack. Are you refusing to obey me?
No.
Osney touched her golden hair. The thing is, the best lies have some truth in them. To give them flavor, as it were.
And you want me to go tell how I fucked a queen?
She almost slapped his face, almost. But she had gone too far and too much was at stake. All I do for Tommen. She turned her head and caught Sir Osney's hand with her own, kissing his fingers. They were rough and hard, calloused from the sword. Robert had hands like that, she thought. Circe wrapped her arms about his neck.
I would not want it said. I made a liar of you, she whispered in a husky voice. Give me an hour, and meet me in my bedchamber.
We waited long enough. He thrust his fingers inside the bodice of her gown and yanked, and the silk parted with a ripping sound so loud that Circe was afraid that half of the Red Keep must have heard it.
Take off the rest before I tear that, too, he said. You can keep the crown on. I like you in the crown.
Eddard. He dreamt an old dream of three knights in white cloaks and a tower long fallen, and Lyanna in a bed of blood. In the dream, his friends rode with him, as they had in life. Proud Martin Cassel, Jory's father, faithful Theowell, Ethan Glover, who had been Brandon's squire, Sir Mark Risewell, soft of speech and gentle of heart, The Crannog man, Howland Reed, Lord Dustin, on his great red stallion. Ned had known their faces as well as he knew his own once, but the years leech at a man's memories, even those he has vowed never to forget. In the dream they were only shadows, grey wraiths on horses made of mist. They were seven facing three, in the dream as it had been in life. Yet these were no ordinary three. They waited before the Round Tower, the red mountains of dawn at their backs, their white cloaks billowing in the wind. And these were no shadows. Their faces burn clear even now. Sir Arthur Dane, the Sword of the Morning, had a sad smile on his lips. The hilt of the great sword Dawn poked up over his right shoulder. Sir Oswald Went was on one knee, sharpening his blade with a whetstone. Across his white enameled helm, the black bat of his house spread its wings. Between them stood fierce old Sir Gerald Hightower, the White Bull, Lord Commander of the King's Guard. "I looked for you on the Trident," Ned said to them. "We were not there," Sir Gerald answered. "Woe to the usurper if we had been," said Sir Oswald. "When King's Landing fell, Sir Jamie slew your king with a golden sword, and I wondered where you were." "Far away," Sir Gerald said, "or Ares would yet sit on the Iron Throne, and our false brother would burn in seven hells." "I came down on Storm's End to lift the siege," Ned told them, "and the Lords Tyrell and Redwine dipped their banners and all their knights bent their knee to pledge us fealty. I was certain you would be among them." "Our knees do not bend easily," said Sir Arthur Dane. "Sir Willem Darry is fled to Dragonstone with your queen and Prince Viserys. I thought you might have sailed with him." "Sir Willem is a good man and true," said Sir Oswald. "But not of the King's Guard," Sir Gerard pointed out. "The King's Guard does not flee." "Then or now," said Sir Arthur. He donned his helm. "We swore a vow," explained old Sir Gerald. Ned's wraiths moved up beside him with shadow swords in hand. They were seven against three. "And now it begins," said Sir Arthur Dane, the Sword of the Morning. He unsheathed Dawn and held it with both hands. The blade was pale as milk glass, alive with light. "No," Ned said with sadness in his voice, "now it ends." As they came together in a rush of steel and shadow, he could hear Lyanna screaming, "Eddard!" she called. A storm of rose petals blew across a blood-streaked sky, as blue as the eyes of death. "Lord Eddard!" Lyanna called out again. "I promise," he whispered. "Leah, I promise." "Lord Eddard!" a man echoed from the dark. Groaning, Eddard Stark opened his eyes. Moonlight streamed through the tall windows of the Tower of the Hand. "Lord Eddard!" A shadow stood over his bed. How long? The sheets were tangled, his legs splinted and plastered. A dull throb of pain shot up his side. 6 days and 7 nights," the voice was Van Poole's. The steward held a cup to Ned's lips. "Drink, my lord." "What, only water? Maester Purcell said you would be thirsty." Ned drank. His lips were parched and cracked. The water tasted sweet as honey. "The king left orders," Van Poole told him. When the cup was empty, "he would speak with you, my lord." "On the morrow," Ned said, "when I am stronger." He could not face Robert now. The dream had left him weak as a kitten. "My lord," Poole said, "he commanded us to send you to him the moment you opened your eyes." The steward busied himself lighting a bedside candle. Ned cursed softly. Robert was never known for his patience. "Tell him I'm too weak to come to him. If he wishes to speak to me, I should be pleased to receive him here. I hope you wake him from a sound sleep and summon—" He was about to say Jory when he remembered. "Summon the captain of my guard." Alan stepped into the bedchamber a few moments after the steward had taken his leave. "My lord," "Paul tells me it has been 6 days," Ned said. "I must know how things stand." "The Kingslayer has fled the city," Alan told him. "The talk is he's ridden back to a Castle Rock to join his father. The story of how Lady Catelyn took the imp is on every lip. I have put on extra guards, if it please you." "It does," Ned assured him. "My daughters?" "They have been with you every day, my lord. Sansa prays quietly, but Arya..." He hesitated. "She has not said a word since they brought you back. She's a fierce little thing, my lord. I've never seen such anger in a girl." "Whatever happens," Ned said, "I want my daughters kept safe. I fear this is only the beginning." "No harm will come to them, Lord Eddard," Alan said. "I stake my life on that." "Jorri and the others?" "I gave them over to the Silent Sisters to be sent north to Winterfell. Jorri would want to lie beside his grandfather." "It would have to be his grandfather, for Jorri's father was buried far to the south. Martin Cassel had perished with the rest. Ned had pulled the tower down afterward and used its bloody stones to build 8 cairns upon the ridge. It was said that Rhaegar had named the place the Tower of Joy. But for Ned, it was a bitter memory. They had been 7 against 3, yet only 2 had lived to ride away. Eddard Stark himself, and the little Crannog man, Howland Reed. He did not think it omened well that he should dream that dream again, after so many years. "You've done well, Alan," Ned was saying when Vaen Poole returned. The steward bowed low. "His grace is without, my lord, and the queen with him." Ned pushed himself up higher, wincing as his leg trembled with pain. He had not expected Cersei to come. It did not bode well that she had. "Send them in and leave us. What we have to say should not go beyond these walls." Poole withdrew quietly. Robert had taken time to dress. He wore a black velvet doublet with a crown stag of Baratheon worked upon the breast in golden thread, and a golden mantle with a cloak of black and gold squares. A flagon of wine in his hand, his face already flushed from drink. Cersei Lannister entered behind him, a jewel tiara in her hair. "Your grace," Ned said, "your pardons, I cannot rise."
"No matter," the king said gruffly. "Some wine, eh, from the arbour, a good vintage."
"A small cup," Ned said. "My head is still heavy from the milk of the puppy." "A man in your place should count himself fortunate that his head is still on his shoulders," the queen declared.
"Quiet, woman," Robert snapped.
He brought Ned a cup of wine.
"Does the leg still pain you?"
"Some," Ned said. His head was swimming, but it would not do to admit to weakness in front of the queen.
"Pycelle swears it will heal clean," Robert frowned. "I take it you know what Catelyn has done?"
"I do." Ned took a small swallow of wine. "My lady wife is blameless, your grace. All she did at my command."
"I'm not pleased, Ned," Robert grumbled.
"By what right do you dare lay hands on my blood?" Cersei demanded. "Who do you think you are?"
"The hand of the king," Ned told her with icy courtesy. "Charged by your own lord husband to keep the king's peace and enforce the king's justice."
"You were the hand of the king," Cersei began, "but now..."
"Silence!" the king roared. "You asked him a question, and he answered it."
Cersei subsided, cold with anger, and Robert turned back to Ned.
"Keep the king's peace, you say. Is that how you keep the king's peace, Ned?"
7 men are dead." 8, the queen corrected. "Trigar died this morning of the blow Lord Stark gave him."
"Abductions on the king's road and drunken slaughter in the streets," the king said. "I will not have it, Ned."
"Catelyn had good reason for taking the imp."
"I said I will not have it. To hell with her reasons. You will command her to release the dwarf at once, and you will make your peace with Jaime."
3 of my men were butchered before my eyes because Jaime Lannister wished to chase me.
Am I to forget that?"
"My brother was not the cause of the quarrel," Cersei told the king. "Lord Stark was returning drunk from a brothel.
His men attacked Jaime and his guards, even as his wife attacked Tyrion on the King's Road.
You know me better than that, Robert, Ned said. Ask Lord Baelish if you doubt me. He was there. I've talked to Littlefinger, Robert said. He claims he rode off to bring the gold cloaks before the fighting began, but he admits you were returning from some whorehouse. Some whorehouse? Damn your eyes, Robert. I went there to have a look at your daughter. Her mother has named her Bara. She looks like that first girl you fathered, when we were boys together in the Vale. He watched the Queen as he spoke. Her face was a mask, still and pale, betraying nothing. Robert flushed.
Bara, he grumbled. Is that supposed to please me? Damn the girl. I thought she had more sense.
She cannot be more than 15, and a whore. And you thought she had sense? Ned said, incredulous. His leg was beginning to pain him sorely. It was hard to keep his temper. The fool child is in love with you, Robert. The king glanced at Cersei.
This is no fit subject for the queen's ears.
Her grace will have no liking for anything I have to say, Ned replied. I am told the Kingslayer has fled the city. Give me leave to bring him back to justice. The king swirled the wine in his cup, brooding. He took a swallow.
No, he said. I want no more of this. Jaime slew 3 of your men, and you 5 of his. Now it ends.
Is that your notion of justice? Ned flared. If so, I am pleased that I am no longer your hand. The queen looked to her husband. If any man had dared to speak to a Targaryen as he has spoken to you...
Did you take me for Ares?
Robert interrupted. I took you for a king. Jaime and Tyrion are your own brothers by all the laws of marriage and the bonds we share. The Starks have driven off the one and seized the other. This man dishonors you with every breath he takes, and yet you stand there meekly, asking if his leg pains him, and would he like some wine?
Robert's face was dark with anger.
How many times must I tell you, told your tongue, woman?
Cersei's face was a study in contempt. What a jape the gods have made of us two, she said.
By all rights, you ought to be in skirts, and me in mail.
Purple with rage, the king lashed out, a vicious backhand blow to the side of the head. She stumbled against the table and fell hard. Yet Cersei Lannister did not cry out. Her slender fingers brushed her cheek, where the pale, smooth skin was already reddening. On the morrow, the bruise would cover half her face. I shall wear this as a badge of honor, she announced.
Wear it in silence, or I'll honor you again, Robert vowed.
He shouted for a guard. Sir Meryn Trant stepped into the room, tall and somber in his white armor.
The queen is tired. See her to her bedchamber.
The knight helped Cersei to her feet and led her out without a word. Robert reached for the flagon and refilled his cup.
You see what she does to me, Ned?
The king seated himself, cradling his wine cup.
My loving wife, the mother of my children.
The rage was gone from him now. In his eyes, Ned saw something sad and scared.
I should not have hit her. That was not kingly.
He stared down at his hands as if he did not quite know what they were.
I was always strong. No one could stand before me, no one. How do you fight someone if you can't hit them?
Confused, the king shook his head.
Rhaegar won, damn him. I killed him, Ned. I drove the spike right through that black armor into his black heart, and he died at my feet. They made up songs about it. Yet somehow, he still won. He has Lyanna now, and I have her.
The king drained his cup. Your Grace, Ned Stark said, we must talk. Robert pressed his fingertips against his temples.
I'm sick unto death of talk, and the morrow I'm going to the King's Wood to hunt. Whatever you have to say can wait until I return.
If the guards are good, I shall not be here on your return. You commanded me to return to Winterfell, remember? Robert stood up, grasping one of the bedposts to steady himself.
The guards are seldom good, Ned. Here, this is yours.
He pulled the heavy silver handclasp from a pocket in the lining of his cloak and tossed it on the bed.
Like it or not, you are my hand, damn you. I forbid you to leave.
Ned picked up the silver clasp. He was being given no choice, it seemed. His leg throbbed, and he felt as helpless as a child. The Targaryen girl, the king groaned.
Seven hells, don't start with her again. That's done. I'll hear no more of it.
Why would you want me as your hand, if you refuse to listen to my counsel?
Why? Robert laughed. Why not? Somebody has to rule this damnable kingdom. Put on the badge, Ned. It suits you. And if you ever throw it in my face again, I swear to you, I'll pin the damn thing on Jaime Lannister.
John. Val waited by the gate in the pre-dawn cold, wrapped up in a bearskin cloak so large it might well have fit Sam. Beside her was a Garan, saddled and bridled, a shaggy grey with one white eye. Molly and Dolorous Ed stood with her, a pair of unlikely guards, their breath frosted in the cold black air. "You gave her a blind horse?" John said, incredulous.
"He's only half blind, my lord," offered Molly. "Elsewise, he's sound enough."
He patted the Garan on the neck.
"The horse may be half blind, but I am not," said Val. "I know where I must go."
"My lady, you do not have to do this. The risk
is mine, Lord Snow, and I am no Southron lady, but a woman of the free folk. I know the forest better than all your black cloak rangers. It holds no ghosts for me."
"I hope not." John was counting on that, trusting that Val could succeed where Black Jack Bulwer and his companions had failed. She need fear no harm from the free folk, he hoped. But both of them knew too well that wildlings were not the only ones waiting in the woods. "You have sufficient food?"
"Hard bread, hard cheese, oat cakes, salt cod, salt beef, salt mutton, and a skin of sweet wine to rinse all that salt out of my mouth. I will not die of hunger."
"Then it's time you were away."
"You have my word, Lord Snow. I will return, with Tormund or without him."
Val glanced at the sky. The moon was but half full.
"Look for me on the first day of the full moon."
"I will. Do not fail me," he thought, "or Stannis will have my head." "Do I have your word that you will keep our princess closely?" the king had said, and John had promised that he would. "Val is no princess, though. I told him that 50 times. It was a feeble sort of evasion, a sad rag wrapped around his wounded word. His father would never have approved. "I am the sword that guards the realm of men," John reminded himself, "and in the end, that must be worth more than one man's honor." The road beneath the wall was as dark and cold as the belly of an ice dragon and as twisty as a serpent. Dolorous Ed led them through with a torch in hand. Molly had the keys for the three gates, where bars of black iron as thick as a man's arm closed off the passage. Spearmen at each gate knuckled their foreheads at Jon Snow, but stared openly at Val and her Garan. When they emerged north of the wall, through a thick door made of freshly hewn green wood, the wildling princess paused for a moment to gaze out across the snow-covered field where King Stannis had won his battle. Beyond, the haunted forest waited, dark and silent. The light of the half-moon turned Val's honey-blonde hair a pale silver and her cheeks as white as snow. She took a deep breath. "The air tastes sweet. My tongue is too numb to tell. All I can taste is cold." "Cold?" Val laughed lightly. "No, When it is cold, it will hurt to breathe. When the others come... The thought was a disquieting one. Six of the rangers John had sent out were still missing. It is too soon. They may yet be back. But another part of him insisted, they are dead, every man of them. You sent them out to die, and you are doing the same to Val. Tell Tormund what I've said.
He may not heed your words, but he will hear them.
Val kissed him lightly on the cheek.
You have my thanks, Lord Snow, for the half-blind horse, the salt cud, the free air, for hope.
Their breath mingled, a white mist in the air. John Snow drew back and said, "The only thanks I want is Tormund Giantsbane, aye?" Val pulled up the hood of her bearskin. The brown pelt was well salted with grey. "Before I go, one question. Did you kill Jarl, my lord?"
"The wall killed Jarl."
"So I'd heard, but I had to be sure." "You have my word. I did not kill him, though I might have, if things had gone otherwise."
"This is farewell, then," she said almost playfully.
Jon Snow was in no mood for it. "It is too cold and dark to play, and the hour is too late. Only for a time you will return, for the boy, if for no other reason."
"Craster's son," Val shrugged. "He is no kin to me."
"I've heard you singing to him."
"I was singing to myself. Am I to blame if he listens?"
A faint smile brushed her lips.
"It makes him laugh. Oh, very well. He is a sweet little monster."
"Monster?"
"His milk name. I had to call him something. See that he stays safe and warm, for his mother's sake and mine, and keep him away from the Red Woman. She knows who he is. She sees things in her fires."
"Arya," he thought, hoping it was so. "Ashes and cinders. Kings and dragons." Dragons again. For a moment John could almost see them too, coiling in the night, their dark wings outlined against a sea of flame. "If she knew, she would have taken the boy away from us. Darla's boy, not your monster. A word in the king's ear would have been the end of it. End of me. Stannis would have taken it for treason." "Why let it happen if she knew?"
"Because it suited her. Fire is a fickle thing. No one knows which way a flame will go."
Val put a foot into a stirrup, swung her leg over a horse's back, and looked down from the saddle.
"Do you remember what my sister told you?"
"Yes. A sword without a hilt, with no safe way to hold it. But Melisandre had the right of it. Even a sword without a hilt is better than an empty hand when foes are all around you."
"Good."
Val wheeled the Garan towards the north.
"The first night of the full moon, then."
John watched her ride away, wondering if he would ever see her face again. "I'm no southern lady," he could hear her say, "but a woman of the free folk."
"I don't care what she says," muttered Dolorous Ed as Val vanished behind a stand of soldier pines. "The air is so cold, it hurts to breathe. I would stop, but that would hurt worse."
He rubbed his hands together.
"This is going to end badly."
"You say that of everything."
"Aye, my lord, usually I'm right."
Molly clears his throat.
"My lord, the wildling princess, letting her go. The men may say that I'm half a wildling myself. A turncloak, who means to sell the realm to our raiders, cannibals, and giants."
John did not need to stare into a fire to know what was being said of him. The worst part was, they were not wrong, not wholly. Words are wind, and the wind is always blowing at the wall. Come. It was still dark when John returned to his chambers behind the armory. Ghost was not yet back, he saw. Still hunting. The big white direwolf was gone more oft than not of late, ranging farther and farther in search of prey. Between the men of the watch and the wildlings down in Molestown, the hills and fields near Castle Black had been hunted clean, and there had been little enough game to begin with. Winter is coming, John reflected, and soon, too soon. He wondered if they would ever see a spring. Dolorous Ed made the trek to the kitchens and soon was back with a tankard of brown ale and a covered platter. Under the lid, John discovered 3 duck's eggs fried in drippings, a strip of bacon, 2 sausages, a blood pudding, and 1/2 a loaf of bread, still warm from the oven. He ate the bread and 1/2 an egg. He would have eaten the bacon too, but the raven made off with it before he had the chance. Thief, John said, as the bird flapped up to the lintel above the door to devour its prize.
Thief,
the raven agreed. John tried a bite of sausage. He was washing the taste from his mouth with a sip of ale when Ed returned to tell him Bowen Marsh was without.
"'As hell's with him, and Septon Celador."
That was quick. He wondered who was telling tales, and if there was more than one.
"Send them in." "Aye, my lord. You'll want to watch your sausages with this lot, though. They have a hungry look about them."
Hungry was not the word John would have used. Septon Celador appeared confused and groggy, and in dire need of some scales from the dragon that had flamed him, whilst first builder, Othel Yarwick, looked as if he'd swallowed something he could not quite digest. Bowen Marsh was angry. John could see it in his eyes, the tightness around his mouth, the flush to those round cheeks. That red is not from cold. "Please sit," he said. "May I offer you food or drink?"
"We broke our fast in the commons," said Marsh. "I could do with more." Yarwick eased himself down onto a chair. "Good of you to offer." "Perhaps some wine," said Septon Celador.
"Corn!" screamed the raven from the lintel. "Corn! Corn!"
"Wine for the Septon, and a plate for our first builder," John told Dolorous Ed. "Nothing for the bird." He turned back to his visitors. "Your hair about Val?"
"And other matters," said Bowen Marsh. "The men have concerns, my lord."
"And who is it who appointed you to speak for them?"
"As do I, Othel. How goes the work at the Night Fort?
I have had a letter from Sir Axel Florent, who styles himself the Queen's Hand. He tells me that Queen Selyse is not pleased with her quarters at Eastwatch by the sea, and wishes to move into her husband's new seat at once. Will that be possible?" Yarwick shrugged. "We've got most of the keep restored and put a roof back on the kitchens. She'd need food and furnishings and firewood, mind you, but it might serve. Not so many comforts as Eastwatch, to be sure, and a long way from the ships, should Her Grace wish to leave us, but she could live there, though it will be years before the place looks a proper castle. Sooner if I had more builders."
"I could offer you a giant." That gave Othel a start.
"The monster in the yard? His name is Wanweg Wondawong, Leathers tells me. A lot to wrap a tongue around, I know. Leathers calls him One-One, and that seems to serve. One-One was very little like the giants in old Nan's tales, those huge savage creatures who mixed blood into their morning porridge and devoured whole bulls, hair and hide and horns. This giant ate no meat at all, though he was a holy terror when served a basket of roots, crunching onions and turnips and even raw hard neeps between his big square teeth. He is a willing worker, though getting him to understand what you want is not always easy. He speaks the old tongue after a fashion, but nothing of the common. Tireless, though, and his strength is prodigious. He could do the work of a dozen men."
My lord, the men would never. Giants eat human flesh, I think. No, my lord, I thank you, but I do not have the men to watch over such a creature.
Jon Snow was unsurprised. As you wish, we will keep the giant here. Truth be told, he would have been loath to part with 1-1. You know nothing, Jon Snow, Ygritte might say. But Jon spoke with the giant whenever he could, through Leathers, or one of the free folk they had brought back from the grove, and was learning much and more about his people and their history. He only wished that Sam was here to write the stories down. That was not to say that he was blind to the danger 1-1 represented. The giant would lash out violently when threatened, and those huge hands were strong enough to rip a man apart. He reminded John of Hodor. Hodor twice as big, twice as strong, and half as clever. There's a thought to sober even Septon Celador. But if Tormund's had giants with him, one wed one dar one may help us treat with them. Mormon's raven muttered his annoyance as the door opened beneath him, heralding the return of Dolorous Ed with a flagon of wine and a plate of eggs and sausages. Beaun Marsh waited with obvious impatience as Ed poured, resuming only when he left again. Tullet is a good man and well-liked, and Arryn Emmett has been a fine master at arms, he said then. Yet the talk is that you mean to send them away. We need good men at Long Barrow. Whore's Hole, the men have started calling it, said March. But be that as it may, is it true that you mean to replace Emmett with the savage Leathers as our master at arms? That is an office most often reserved for knights, or rangers at the least. Leathers is savage, John agreed mildly. I can attest to that. I've tried him in the practice yard. He's as dangerous with a stone axe as most knights are with castle-forged steel. I grant you he's not as patient as I'd like, and some of the boys are terrified of him. But that's not all for the bad. One day they'll find themselves in a real fight, and a certain familiarity with terror will serve them well.
He's a wildling.
He was, until he said the words. Now he is our brother, one who can teach the boys more than swordcraft. It would not hurt them to learn a few words of the old tongue and something of the ways of the free folk.
Free,
the raven muttered.
Corn, king.
But the men do not trust him. Which men, John might have asked. How many? But that would lead him down a road he did not mean to ride. I'm sorry to hear that. Is there more? Septon Celador spoke up.
This boy, Satin, it said you mean to make him your steward and squire in Tollet's place.
My lord, the boy's a whore, dare I say, a painted catamite from the brothels of Old Town. And you are a drunk. What he was in Old Town is none of our concern. He's quick to learn and very clever. The other recruits started out despising him, but he won them over and made friends of them all. He's fearless in a fight, and can even read and write after a fashion. He should be capable of fetching me my meals and saddling my horse, don't you think?
Most like, said Beaun Marsh, stony-faced. But the men do not like it. Traditionally, the Lord Commander's squires are lads of good birth, being groomed for command. Does my lord believe the men of the Night's Watch would ever follow a whore into battle?
John's temper flashed. They have followed worse. The old bear left a few cautionary notes about certain of the men for his successor. We have a cook at the Shadow Tower who was fond of raping scepters. He burned a 7-pointed star into his flesh for everyone he claimed. His left arm is stars from wrist to elbow, and stars mark his calves as well. At Eastwatch, we have a man who set his father's house afire and barred the door. His entire family burned to death, all 9. Whatever Saturn may have done in Old Town, he is our brother now, and he will be my squire. Septon Celador drank some wine. Othel Yarwick stabbed a sausage with his dagger. Beaun Marsh sat red-faced.
The raven flapped his wings and said, "Court! Court! Kill!" Finally, the Lord Steward cleared his throat.
"Your lordship knows best, I'm sure. Might I ask about these corpses in the ice cells? They make the men uneasy, and to keep them under guard. Surely that is a waste of two good men, unless you fear that they
will rise? I pray they do." Septon Celador paled.
"Seven save us."
Wine dribbled down his chin in a red line.
"Lord Commander, wights are monstrous, unnatural creatures, abominations before the eyes of the gods. You cannot mean to try to talk with them?"
"Can they talk?" asked Jon Snow. "I think not, but I cannot claim to know. Monsters they may be, but they were men before they died. How much remains? The one I slew was intent on killing Lord Commander Mormont. Plainly, it remembered who he was and where to find him." Maester Aemon would have grasped his purpose, Jon did not doubt. Sam Tarly would have been terrified, but he would have understood as well. "My lord father used to tell me that a man must know his enemies. We understand little of the whites, and less about the others. We need to learn." That answer did not please them. Septon Celador fingered the crystal that hung about his neck and said,
"I think this most unwise, Lord Snow. I shall pray to the crone to lift her shining lamp and lead you down the path of wisdom."
Jon Snow's patience was exhausted. "We could all do with a bit more wisdom, I'm sure." "You know nothing, Jon Snow."
"Now, shall we speak of Val?" "It is true, then," said Marsh. "You have released her."
"Beyond the wall."
Septon Celador sucked in his breath. "The king's prize? His grace will be most wroth to find her gone.
Val will return."
"Before Stannis, if the gods are good." "Well, how can you know that?" demanded Bowen Marsh.
"She said she would."
"And if she lied, if she meets with misadventure?"
"Why, then, you may have a chance to choose a Lord Commander more to your liking. Until such time, I fear you'll still need to suffer me."
Jon took a swallow of ale. "I sent her to find Tormund Giantsbane and bring him my offer." "If we may know, what offer is this?"
"The same offer I made at Molestown, food and shelter and peace. If he will join his strength to ours, fight our common enemy, help us hold the wall."
Bowen Marsh did not appear surprised. "You mean to let him pass?"
His voice suggested he had known all along.
"To open the gates for him and his followers, hundreds, thousands. If he has that many left."
Septon Celador made the sign of the star.
Othel Yarwick grunted. Bowen Marsh said, "Some might call this treason. These are wildlings, savages, raiders, rapers, more beasts than man."
"Tormund is none of those things," said John. "No more than Mance Rayder. But even if every word you said were true, they are still men, Bowen. Living men, human as you and me. Winter is coming, my lords, and when it does, we living men will need to stand together against the dead."
"Snow!" screamed Lord Mormont's raven. "Snow! Snow!"
John ignored him. "We have been questioning the wildlings we brought back from the grove. Several of them told an interesting tale of a woods witch called Mother Mole."
"Mother Mole?" said Bowen Marsh. "An unlikely name."
"Supposedly she made her home in a burrow beneath a hollow tree. Whatever the truth of that, she had a vision of a fleet of ships arriving to carry the free folk to safety across the narrow sea. Thousands of those who fled the battle were desperate enough to believe her. Mother Mole has led them all to Hardhome, there to pray and await salvation from across the sea." Athel Yarwick scowled. "I'm no ranger, but Hardhome is an unholy place,
it said.
Cursed! Even your uncle used to say as much, Lord Snow. Why would they go there?
John had a map before him on the table. He turned it so they could see. Hardhome sits on a sheltered bay and has a natural harbour deep enough for the bigger ships afloat. Wood and stone are plentiful near there. The waters teem with fish, and there are colonies of seals and sea cows close at hand.
All that's true, I don't doubt, said Jarvik. But it's not a place I'd want to spend a night. You know the tale.
He did. Hardhome had been halfway toward becoming a town, the only true town north of the wall, until the night, 600 years ago, when hell had swallowed it. Its people had been carried off into slavery or slaughtered for meat, depending on which version of the tale you believed, their homes and halls consumed in a conflagration that burned so hot that watchers on the wall far to the south had thought the sun was rising in the north. Afterward, ashes rained down on haunted forest and shivering sea alike for almost half a year. Traders reported finding only nightmarish devastation where Hardhome had stood. A landscape of charred trees and burned bones. Waters choked with swollen corpses. Blood-chilling shrieks echoing from the cave mouths that pocked the great cliff that loomed above the settlement. 6 centuries had come and gone since that night, but Hardhome was still shunned. The wild had reclaimed the site, John had been told, but rangers claimed that the overgrown ruins were haunted by ghouls and demons and burning ghosts with an unhealthy taste for blood. It is not the sort of refuge I'd choose either, John said, but Mother Mole was heard to preach that the free folk would find salvation where once they found damnation. Septon Celador pursed his lips.
Salvation can be found only through the Seven. This witch has doomed them all. And saved the wall, mayhaps, said Bowen Marsh. These are enemies we speak of. Let them pray amongst the ruins, and if their gods send ships to carry them off to a better world, well and good. In this world I have no food to feed them.
John flexed the fingers of his sword hand. Cutter Pike's galleys sail past Hardhome from time to time. He tells me there is no shelter there but the caves. The screaming caves, his men call them. Mother Mole and those who followed her will perish there, of cold and starvation, hundreds of them, thousands.
As thousands of enemies, thousands of wildlings.
Thousands of people, John thought. Men, women, children. Anger rose inside him. But when he spoke, his voice was quiet and cold. Are you so blind? Or is it that you do not wish to see? What do you think will happen when all these enemies are dead? Above the door, the raven muttered,
Dead! Dead! Dead!
Let me tell you what will happen, John said. The dead will rise again, in their hundreds and their thousands. They will rise as whites, with black hands and pale blue eyes, and they will come for us. He pushed himself to his feet, the fingers of his sword hand opening and closing. You have my leave to go. Septon Celador rose, grey-faced and sweating. Othel Jarvik stiffly. Bowen Marsh tight-lipped and pale.
I thank you for your time, Lord Snow.
They left without another word.
Bran. The tower stood upon an island, its twin reflected on the still blue waters. When the wind blew, ripples moved across the surface of the lake, chasing one another like boys at play. Oak trees grew thick along the lake shore, a dense stand of them with a litter of fallen acorns on the ground beneath. Beyond them was a village, or